because it was quite eventful, wasn't it? It's fair to say.
It was, yeah. I think the events for me really started when I was two. I was born to my mum, who was 44 at the time, and she basically had an affair with somebody who was at work with her, and it broke her marriage up, and she ended up living in a flat trying to look after me. She had three other daughters, who the youngest was 15, and the eldest had grown up and got married as well. So she had a really difficult time at the age of 44 trying to bring up this baby after her marriage had broken down as well. And I think at the age of two, it became too much for her. She'd asked for help from the social services a few times, but it just got too much for her, because what happened when I was two was that my mum decided to give me to a neighbour and then disappeared and was never seen again. The neighbour promised not to tell the social services for a couple of days to give her a good head start, and she disappeared, and that was the last I ever heard of my mum. I was taken into care, and I was moved around a couple of children's homes initially, and then ended up with a foster family. So I've spent my life growing up in care, and I think it's safe to say that as I grew up in my younger years, I grew up quite angry. I grew up angry with the world. I grew up angry with the start that I'd had in life, and I kind of threw any love or affection that was shown to me, I threw that back in people's faces, including those that had loved me into giving me a home as well, my foster parents. Anything to do with authority, I rebelled against. So it was quite a difficult childhood, although I was in a loving family, I wasn't accepting that love. And then as we got to sort of the age of around 13, things started to take a turn for the worst.
Right.
I started drinking alcohol, quite a lot of alcohol, to try and escape life. I think I was just feeling empty inside and not worth anything, and I was just trying to escape life, really. Alcohol didn't seem to be enough for me, so I ended up glue sniffing in those days. Glue sniffing was the trend of basically how to get off your head and just escape the world. So I used to get some glue in a carrier bag and sit up in the park basically just get off my head on glue. Obviously this had a knock-on effect. I wasn't doing well at school. I rebelled at school as well. I was almost expelled from one school, but I managed to cling on with the skin of my teeth. Growing up into my teenage years was a really, really difficult time.
So not a very average childhood.
You could say that, yeah, you could say that. But I don't think it was, the fault of my foster parents, those that looked after me. I think it was the fact that I just grew up so angry. Inside with the world and what had been thrown at me. And I kind of rebelled against that, and I rebelled against anyone that showed me any form of love.
Sure. So that's kind of your young teenage years, and then you went into the army quite young, 16, is that right?
Yeah.
So what on earth, I mean, that sounds a very odd change to go from that kind of life into what would be a regimented life, I guess.
Yeah.
What prompted that?
I think I was always looking for an escape. I knew that my foster years were coming to an end. I needed to do something. I didn't feel capable of being on my own in the world. So I was looking for, when my foster family is no longer able to take care of me, who is going to take care of me? And in 1982, we all know that the Falklands War happened. I was 14 years old at the time, saw the Falklands War as a televised war, and it was one of the first ever televised war, and followed it quite intimately and thought, maybe that's what I'm looking for, maybe that's what I need to do. So I went along to the Army Careers Office at the age of 15, and I said, I want to be a soldier. They took one look at me and said, right, okay, well, let's sit down and talk about this. Basically told me that if I stayed out of trouble, because I've been in trouble with the police as well, if I stayed out of trouble for 6 months, they would give me an opportunity to join the army to see if the army could turn my life around. So for them 6 months, I think I managed to run a lot faster and get away from the police whenever I could, but I did manage to stay out of trouble. And at 16 years old, 8.5 stone, because I wasn't looking after myself properly, I joined the army. Initially, the shock of capture, of being in the army, kind of took over. And initially, it was not too bad. I thought, well, you know, this is going to be all right. Had a bit of a difficult training to get through training because of my hatred towards anything that was establishment and things like that. So I had a lot to overcome there. But I got through a year's training as a boy soldier, and I joined my regiment at 17. And at 17 and a half, found myself in West Belfast on an operational tour.
Nice. So the troubles were still on at this point?
The troubles were very much on. Yep. In 1987. It was my first operational tour. And I would say that in 5 months, I was boy to man. Very, very quickly grew up when you're put into an environment like
that.
It was a tough tour. We lost 4 soldiers on that tour and a number of other injuries.
When you say lost, as in they were killed in
action?
They
were killed in action, yeah, and quite a lot of other injuries.
Yeah.
A lot of which I saw and experienced, and I think it definitely made me sort of grow up from boy to man at that point. My army career went on a little bit after that, and then I started to drift back into my old ways again.
And so you were still in the army as you.
I was. I'd been in the army for probably about 5 years, and then hit a bit of a low patch in my life, and ended up back on the drink quite heavily. I mean, the army culture in the 80s was quite a heavy drinking culture. You work hard, you play hard. But that drinking got a little bit too much for me, and it took me back to where I was in my teenage years of using drink to kind of escape. And I ended up doing that more and more in the army. Got into a relationship, thought maybe this is what I'm looking for, maybe this is what I need, because the army wasn't working for me then, and got married very young.
So how old?
I was 19 years old.
Right.
When I first got married. We had a relationship which was, to say the least, it was quite rocky. I have 2 wonderful children from that marriage. But the marriage was such that, because what was going on with me, I was just feeling empty. And I was in this marriage, but it was empty. It was just existing. It wasn't love in any way that you would expect in a marital relationship. And you know, even though I had, you know, 2 children from that marriage, I was still drinking quite heavily, still serving in the army. Any opportunity when I wasn't on duty, I would hit the bottle quite hard, to the extent that I used to hide a bottle of vodka in my married quarter in the toilet system, and wander off upstairs to go to the toilet, and I'd be drinking the vodka out of the bottle during a relationship where I was supposed to be a father and a husband.
Now, this obviously, that your marriage, I guess, wasn't going to continue well under those circumstances. Mm. What happened?
It came to a head when my ex-wife now decided to go and find love elsewhere.
Okay.
We were based in Germany at the time, and she'd moved back to England. We'd had a bit of a really bad patch, and she went back to get some space in England and found somebody else. And I'd found out about that, and that kind of really put me off the rails, because I'd felt at that point that, you know, my mother didn't want me. I grew up quite angry as a teenager. The army was threatening to throw me out for the trouble I was getting into, and now my wife didn't want me either. So I think at that point I'd kind of hit the lowest point of my life. And there was an incident where I went to put my bank card into a bank machine in Germany very late at night after a very heavy session, and found out that my bank account was empty because my wife back in the UK had obviously needed the money, so she emptied the account. I got very, very angry, picked up a paving slab and threw it through the windows of a German bank.
So it wasn't just any old bank, this was a German bank?
This was a bank in Paderborn in Germany, okay, called the Volksbank, of which I now have a lifetime ban from. I'd thrown a paving slab through the door of this bank, gone into the bank to try and retrieve the card from the back of the machine, completely off my head on spirits and at the lowest point of my life. I knew it was going slightly wrong when I heard a helicopter hovering outside the bank.
Lights as well.
And as I glanced around the corner, saw the armed police outside the bank, thinking that their bank was being turned over by a professional gang and not some drunken squaddy who was at the lowest point of his life. I actually thought at one point there that maybe this is my opportunity, that if I storm them, they might open fire and that would be the end of it. So yes. I had considered that while I was sat in this bank wondering what I was going to do. But it came to a swift end when they sent the Alsatian dogs in.
And they weren't coming to have a little, you know, you weren't going to pet the Alsatians and say they're there?
Yeah, I don't think there's any time to pet an attack dog. And they quickly managed to subdue me. But I found myself in a police station cell in Germany. And obviously the RMPs were now involved, the commanding officer had been called into work. And
so the RMPs are?
The Royal Military Police,
okay,
the Red Caps as we call them,
sure,
in the army. They were involved. And it appears that I'd become a bit of a political embarrassment for the armed forces because the Cold War had ended. We still had a lot of soldiers based in Germany, but we were doing that through the grace of the German government. We didn't need to be there, but we didn't have enough barracks back in the UK. So basically we were based in Germany as like a home posting.
Yep.
And here was this soldier who caused this sort of situation in Paderborn in this bank. I was told by a flying lawyer, a solicitor, that I was looking at 8 years because the Germans were taking this quite seriously. But fortunately for me, through some negotiation, they decided to hand me over to the Royal Military Police as long as I was punished accordingly. And I found myself on a court-martial. I was bussed to the rank of private, and I was given 6 months in a military detention centre, MCTC, the Military Corrective Training Centre.
So now, are there still forces out in Germany stationed there?
There are a few, okay, army barracks that have got some British forces still in there.
Sure.
Yeah.
But after this event, they got cleared out pretty quickly, not just because of you.
No, I didn't evacuate Germany from the British forces, no.
Just checking.
No, it wasn't me, no. I did have to pay for the German bank window, which I can say is remarkably expensive, so don't ever anticipate breaking a German bank. I was paying that back for about 5 years.
Thanks for the tip. Vicar storms German bank. Again, I'm a storm.
Yeah.
Sorry,
so,
carry on.
I found myself in military prison. That was an interesting time because it's not like a prison here. You work very hard every day.
Sure.
But for some reason, and I still to this day do not know why, they decided to give me another chance and keep me in the army. How, I don't know. I thought I would be discharged. But at the end of the court-martial, they said, we're going to give you one more opportunity to sort your life out. So I came out of the military prison after 6 months, 6 months and a day.
What was the extra day for?
I got caught trafficking. In the cookhouse in the morning, I swapped a piece of bacon for a sausage with the guy next to me.
And that's trafficking?
And that's called trafficking. And you weren't allowed to do that, so they added a day to my sentence for that.
For
so
one sausage?
It was worth it. The sausage was a lot better than a piece of bacon. I finished my time in the Military Corrective Training Centre and initially started to turn my life around a little bit then. I was going through a divorce back home and I accepted that, you know, that has happened and And that had happened probably because the relationship should never have happened in the first place. But, you know, there was me searching for something in life. And I got promoted again. I was amazed by this. I did quite well on the course. And then I went back again into this pit of depression, thinking, so what? Where's my life going now? What's this all about? Drinking heavy again, hiding it from... my rank structure, hiding it in my room, drinking whenever I could, hiding it from my friends, my closest friends as well in the army. And I was just really not this nice person to be around. Didn't respect people, probably abused the rank I was at corporal as well, a little bit as well. And it got to a point where I definitely hit the lowest point of my life. I was on guard it was in Omagh in Northern Ireland. This is another tour. Yeah, I did about three tours in between all of this. But on a tour in Northern Ireland, when I was in the guard room, and I felt that, my life was going nowhere, and I needed to end it, really. So I took my weapon and my magazine, and I went into the toilet in the barracks, in the guard room, and I sat with my weapon loaded and the muzzle under my chin for about 30 seconds, I think, but I never pulled the trigger. And I thought at the time that the reason I never pulled the trigger was because I was a coward and I couldn't even have the courage to take my own life. That's how low my life had become. About a week later, something happened. I was in the NAFI shop on the barracks, the Navy, Army and Air Force shop, and I was cashing a check. I was stood down for the weekend from patrol, so I was cashing a cheque so I could go and get drunk again. And there was this girl behind the counter who was fairly new to the NAFI, and she started to engage in conversation. So I was talking back to her and got chatting to her. And each time I went into the NAFI shop and she was on, we ended up having this conversation about me, and she was keen to talk about me, and I was kind of like, what's going on here? This is a bit strange because I'm not used to people investing in me and talking about me. She was quite fit as well, so I thought, well, I'm going to ask her out for a date. I managed to pluck up the courage to ask her out for a date, and we went out for a date. My first date with her was Halloween. I know it was the 31st of October and it's Halloween, but it was payday for me. So
okay, so that's the most important thing about
it. If you're going to go out with a soldier, get him on payday. Okay. That's when he's got his money, because it's normally gone after a couple of weeks into the month. But we went out on payday, and I remember having this conversation on the way to the Chinese restaurant, saying, look, I need to tell you a little bit about me. I felt that I needed to be honest with her.
Okay.
So I said, I'm 8 years your senior. I've just gone through a divorce. I've got two children. I've been to prison. I drink quite heavily. In fact, I think that I'm dependent on drink, although I wouldn't call myself an alcoholic, but I can't go a day without alcohol. And just felt that you needed to know, you know, what you were taking on. And she kind of went, okay, well, that's fine. I'll tell you a little bit about me. I've just finished a degree in theology and ministry. I go to church. I used to be in a choir where I played the cello, I think Jesus is really important in my life. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is like chalk and cheese.
So it sounds like a really brilliant fit.
He's just like, I thought this is not going to end well.
So this is pre-internet dating, I believe.
I actually thought, am I going to waste my money on the meal here, because this is not going to go very well. But we stuck it out, and we chatted and we chatted and we chatted, and there was just something about her that kind of got to me, and it was this thing about her saying that she puts her faith in Jesus and her trust in Jesus. And to me, Jesus was this I don't know, you know, I'd heard about this Jesus, but I'd been to church once a year, Remembrance Sunday, in my uniform, stood to attention. That's the only time I'd ever been to church. But we got to get to know each other quite well. And it was about 3 weeks into the relationship where she asked me the dreaded question, will you come to church?
So is this her equivalent of this your big date?
Yeah, this is her equivalent. Right. This is her taking me out on her big date. So she invited me to church, and I was quite hesitant at first. But then I thought, well, hey, the relationship's going all right. There's something about this girl that's quite special. So I plucked up the courage to walk into her church on a Sunday. And I think it's fair to say that when I came out of that building, I was just gobsmacked. And what I was gobsmacked by was the fact that people were so nice. And it was bizarre to me because I'd not been in sort of relationships that were nice. I wasn't a nice person. I'd been in some pretty hairy situations that were not nice as well. But here was this girl in this church environment who, we even got, somebody invited us back to Sunday dinner. A complete stranger invited us back for Sunday dinner after the service, and I'm like, wow, this is just strange. But I kept going back to the church, and I was going back to the church for two reasons. One was because I quite liked her, and the relationship was going well. And the second one was that every time I went back, I got more and more intrigued about this Jesus fella and this Christianity and this people with faith. I got more and more interested in what makes other people tick, because what had made me tick was not those things, was things that were not quite nice.
So it sounds like things were moving then in terms of, well, both in relationship but also where you're at and this kind of gradual growing understanding of who Jesus is.
Yeah.
Is there a point at which something changed in your life?
Yes, there is, yeah. It was,
what was that?
It was 9 months after I started going to the church. It was an evening, we were having a youth session, and I was thinking I was quite down with the kids still, although I was a little bit older than them. And we were having a youth meeting, and we had a travelling team from Belfast over doing some events around the church, and they basically at the end of the evening said, is there anybody that would like any prayer or anything? And I'd never volunteered for anything in church before, and I just stuck my hand up and I said, yeah, I want prayer. Linda, this girl, had fallen off the chair at this point, was like, wow, what's happening here? And I said that I want this life. I want to be in a relationship with Jesus. I want to have Jesus in my life, but I feel that there's this barrier that's holding me back, and I don't know what it is. You know, it's just this barrier that's in the way. And I think, looking back on that, I was thinking, I don't know the Bible. I don't know the stories in the Bible. I don't know, you know, as much as all these people know about Jesus and all these parables they talk about. And, you know, I'd heard them on Sunday, but I felt that I wasn't qualified to be a Christian. But I wanted prayer. And they laid their hands on me and they prayed for me that night. And I can only explain that what happened was as I stood there just trying to receive Jesus into my life, is that I felt this, it was almost like there was a big heavy anchor chain on my chest, and it was being lifted off as they were praying.
It was physical almost.
Almost physical. Sure. It felt like this heavy anchor chain that had been on my chest was being lifted off me. Hmm. And I could feel this happening to me, and at the end of the prayer I was just like, okay, this is it, you know, I'm now giving my life to Jesus, and I am going to turn my life around. And that was the real turning point for me, and I think I was ignited by the Holy Spirit that night. I was on fire for Jesus. There was a lot of clapping, a lot of singing, you know, and I just felt this, what I can only explain now is this immense joy that I'd never, ever experienced in my life. And that was the real turning point for me.
So life changed completely at this point. And now, at this point, you call yourself a Christian, I guess.
Absolutely.
And you're still in the army.
Yeah.
So did your colleagues think you were a complete nutter?
Some people would think I was a nutter, but then I would say, well, have you met my wife? You think I'm a nutter.
Did they think you were a nutter before?
I was a bit of a nutter before anyway, but now there's this, here he is, this guy that, he's found God, you know, this lad who's remember him, you know, the guy who used to get in trouble all the time. All of a sudden he's found God. And I did go through a stage of persecution, mm-hmm. I would say. Not on any level of persecution that some people get around the world, but a lot of teasing. Mm. And it's not nice when you're being teased, especially in a very male-dominated environment, sure. in the infantry, where people are expected to have this edge, you know. And here was this guy who was now calling himself a Christian. I mean, I went all out. I was literally on fire for God. So I was telling people around camp that Jesus loved them. And they were saying, this guy's just lost the plot.
And they knew you before?
Oh, they knew me before. So, they knew all about me before.
Right.
I did go through a bit of a tough time. We were called the God Squad, my group of soldiers. Pete's got his God Squad out and all this sort of stuff. But over time, I sought help from the church, and there was a guy who was in the church who was in the what was then the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, now the PSNI as they call them, and he had gone through a lot of persecution in work as well, and he sat me down and he became sort of an accountability partner, and he helped me through the process. We prayed together, he brought scriptures to me that would help me, you know, blessed are the persecuted, for they would be called the sons of God. And I got to a point where I thought, well, hey, you know, if somebody's having a go at me for being a Christian, then they're thinking about God.
Sure.
So that's good enough for me. And I managed to deal with it. But as time grew on, it's amazing when you're going through this journey and this transformation. And it's not easy. It's not like you flick a switch and then it's all changed. There's a lot of work to do. I had to take a lot to... metaphorically to the foot of the cross, say sorry to Jesus and give it to him to take away from me. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on in my life that needed to be laid down and I needed to step away from. And that was a difficult journey. And I kind of went through this journey alongside the journey of getting people to respect me and understand me in the army as well. Sure. And they both kind of worked alongside each other. And as I grew in my faith, the acceptance grew in the regiment as well.
Okay, that's good.
And it's amazing when you decide to make the right choices through following Jesus and you make these choices daily, that other parts of your life will develop as well and improve. And I suddenly found myself on this amazing promotion journey in the army of this guy who had been to prison in the army and has now was keen to do courses, wanting to come top of the courses, all this kind of thing. And I kind of, every 2 years, I think I hold the record for the amount of outstanding grade confidentials in a row every year, and 2 years promotion, 2 years promotion, 2 years promotion, to the point where I became the regimental sergeant major of the unit.
Okay. Does that mean you have to shout a lot at people?
This is the guy that's in charge of discipline.
Okay.
Who deals with young soldiers who are making the wrong choices in life.
Sure.
has to get a grip of them.
There's a real irony there, isn't there?
Some irony there, definitely, but also an experience that, sure. I could share and show them that how I turned my life around. So it's amazing how that happens.
Now, I guess two questions. We'll stop for a drink in a couple of minutes. Two other questions. One is, I'm guessing this Linda person didn't then just drop by the wayside as you came to know Jesus.
No, she stuck by me.
Okay.
When I became a Christian, our relationship developed. It was great. We spent a lot of time in fellowship together. 2 years later, on the Mount Sinai, I asked her to marry me. She said yes.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, yeah. We were climbing Mount Sinai, and at the top of Mount Sinai, I asked her to marry me. She said yes, and she sat in the audience tonight. We've been married for 16 years. We've had an incredible journey. Linda, you know, when I first met her, had gone through a degree in theology and ministry and was thinking about ordination. Then she married this soldier who took her around the world for the next 15 years. We've had some amazing experiences as I've grown in faith. And then in 2010, Linda felt the call back to ordination. And went back to college in Durham to train for ordination and was ordained in 2012. at the same point that I decided. They'd actually promoted me again from RSM to captain, and I became the unit's welfare officer, which is a real incredible turn of events. But after 3 years as the unit's welfare officer, I resigned my commission and left the forces in order to support Linda in her ministry after she'd supported me in coming to find Jesus and supported me through 15 years of growth in faith. So it was time to say, okay, now it's my turn to support you.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Strangely warming, isn't it?
Definitely. Now,
another strangely warming thing was being out in Iraq. Yes. Is that right?
Yes.
Warming on a different kind of way. So you had a few incidences out there. So can you tell us one or two things, and particularly what got you through?
Yeah, I think the highlight for me as a Christian in the forces was in 2008 in Iraq. We were based in the airfield just outside Basra, and it got to the point where we'd handed Basra back to the Iraqi forces, but they weren't doing a particularly great job and were struggling, and there was a lot of insurgents that had got back into Basra, and it was our role as an infantry battalion to plan an operation to go in and to clear the insurgents out of Basra again. Quite a dangerous operation.
Yeah.
We would expect some casualties and expect some deaths as well. And I remember it was 4 o'clock in the morning. I was a regimental sergeant major. We were on the vehicle park doing our final checks. We were launching at dawn into Basra. And as I walked around the vehicles to give the lads this courage talk and say, you're going to be okay, guys, stick together as a team. One of the vehicles, who was commanded by a sergeant, a good friend of mine, said, sir, we're quite embarrassed to ask this, but is there any chance that you would pray for us and pray for our vehicle?
Yep.
And it kind of blew me away, because that to me was, yeah, this is an acceptance that they know who I am,
sure.
They know what I'm about. And we spent a good 10 minutes praying. The vehicle next door saw what was going on. They wanted a bit of prayer as well. And I ended up literally going around each vehicle praying God's protection as we're going into battle. Some accepted it. Some were like, yeah, whatever, not into all that sort of stuff, We went into battle. We cleared Basra.
Oh, so you managed to get out close to dawn?
We did get out in time. We cleared Basra. It was a little bit messy. And we got nobody killed and no casualties.
Wow.
And I was absolutely amazed. And I definitely believe that God walked alongside us on that journey. And it was a real turning point for me in the forces.
Now, were the Land Rovers, were they okay?
In the early days of Iraq, my first tour was 2003.
Yeah.
And there's this incident that I will never forget as long as I live. We were right at the end of the tour. And we were driving around Basra in Land Rovers.
Yeah.
Because armoured vehicles hadn't been developed. This was a strange war for us.
Yeah.
We'd just gone in and taken over the Black Watch, who had fought the war, and here we were trying to be the peacekeepers in Iraq, and it was a very sort of dangerous environment to be in. It was the day before I was due to come home. I'd done all the clearance checks. I was a sergeant major at the time, company sergeant major, and we'd done all of our checks and everything. I handed in my ammunition. The new regiment was in, taking over, and the company commander of the new regiment needed to go to battle group headquarters, and his company sergeant major didn't know the route yet. So I said, I'll take him. Been there before many a time. So here I am with this new company commander and a couple of guys in the back who provided protection. Drew my ammunition out again, drew my weapon out. We're heading into Basra, and we got ambushed. From the rooftops of two sets of houses, we were literally fired upon from both sides of the rooftop. And it was quite a hairy 20 minutes. We ended up firefighting our way out of there, and we ended up calling for reinforcements and QRF to come, and we were evacuated off there. The vehicle was recovered. And when we got to barracks, got back to our camp, he never actually got to battle group headquarters, but once we got back to our base, the reality of what had just happened was really evident, because there were over, we counted over 100 bullet holes in that Land Rover.
Why is this?
And not one person was hit.
Not one injury?
Not one injury whatsoever.
Right.
A few scary moments, you know, a bit of clothing gone on one guy.
Really?
Where a bullet had passed through his clothing. But we never got hit. And again, I just believe that, you know, God's got plans for me. He's protecting me through this. And when I could get through that, then the future is going to be bright in ministry.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I can't think of much in ministry life that compares to that sort of thing. I'll tell you in a few years' time, I'm sure. I'll probably pick up one or two questions. We'll stop. I'll ask you one question, actually, one more question.
Yeah, sure.
And then we'll stop for a break and some cake and drinks. Lots of people, I know this is the truth as well, that people do think you're a bit of a nutter or, you know, an idiot or, you know, you just, it's bonkers being a Christian. What would you say to someone who comes up to that to you?
I think I would say to somebody that in life you experience happiness and you experience sadness. Everybody does that. Some days you can have a good day and a sad day. I even experienced that. But when you decide to follow Jesus and give your life to Christ and say, right, this is me, this is the life that I'm going to live, you kind of get this sort of inner joy. I only explain as kind of an inner joy in your heart, that whatever happens day to day, that joy will never ever leave me. And those that are Christians and have a faith will probably know what I'm talking about when I talk about this inner joy of a relationship with Jesus. And, you know, yes, salvation and where we're going to end up is amazing, and that's going to be great. I'm ready to go, but there's work to do still first. But this inner joy is like living it day in, day out. Mm. And I always say to those that have this in their hearts, don't keep it there. Share it. Tell other people about it. I want to. That's what I'm doing. I've just started training with the church army to become a church army.
Different kind of army.
Different army, the church army.
No guns.
No guns, definitely no guns.
Okay.
You know, I'm training to become an evangelist.
Sure.
Through the church army, where I've got the skills to add to the toolbox to talk about this amazing journey with Jesus and how, you know, that can turn people's lives around. And it doesn't have to be that you're in the pits to have your life turned around. Jesus was there for me before I ever decided to choose to follow him. He was always there. He's there for everybody. It's you making that decision to say, yes, Jesus, now's the time I'm going to do this.
Sure.
You know, and I would say if you haven't, you know, experience this, then give it a go. Learn more, find out more, go to a church and speak to people, do a discovery course, you know, that talks to you about what faith is. Learn more about this faith. I went on that journey for 9 months, and at the end of that 9 month journey of learning and learning and learning, you know, I decided that I was turning my life around. And I have to say that we are so blessed, you know, and we've been blessed in what we do in Blackpool. Linda is an ordained priest. We're on a council estate in Blackpool, planting a new church, reaching out to people on the estate. You know, I'm going through my church army training at the minute, and life's really exciting. And you can have that same exciting journey. It's there for everybody.
Absolutely. We're going to pause there. Pete, thank you very much indeed at this point. So it'd be great to give Pete a round of applause.
Thank you.
Extraordinary story. Now I've got a